National Radio Club. Heidi Exers, welcome to Market Scope for May 2014. Well, it's back to the Aircheck Library again this month. Enjoy.
It's going to be sunny and cool this afternoon with a high in the upper 40s. Clear and chilly tonight, low 30. Partly sunny, much warmer tomorrow with a high 55. Right now it's 27 in Merrick. And officially, the Empire State Building is up to 29.
C-100.
Dearly beloved.
There's the Tookie Bird for you. If you know what it's worth, all you have to do to win is be caller 100 right now in the studio lines. Good luck.
Hit Radio Z100.
We belong. Hit Radio Z100, Pat Benatar, We Belong, and I'm Mark Sebastian on this Thanksgiving Day for 1984, and got my Tookie Bird winner. Another half-hour commercial free coming up next for you.
The Leather Warehouse is celebrating Thanksgiving with a special sale on two great fashion leather jackets.
Hi, what's your name?
Michelle Guerrero.
Hi, Michelle. Do you know what that Tookie Bird is worth today?
$100.
You got $100 on Thanksgiving Day.
Fantastic.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What do you plan on doing with all that money, dear?
Stuff my turkey.
That's an awfully big turkey, don't you think?
Yes.
All right, why don't you give me that phrase that pays, will you?
Z100 means music.
Serving the universe from the top of the Empire State Building, WHTZ, Newark, New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut's hot rockin' Z100.
Mark Sebastian, hot rockin' flamethrowing Z100.
We double the winning with Super Sticker Prize Package number 2, which includes a brand new AC Chevrolet Camaro Z28 and $5,000 in the glove compartment for you. Grab a Z100 degree shampoo Super Sticker at Wendy's or at the new AC Chevrolet 3085 Kennedy Boulevard in Union City and stick it on to win. 11:09, Thanksgiving morning. Here comes Sheena Easton, Strut.
Hot hits from the flamethrower.
Hot hit Z100. The lady used to be with Rufus. That is Chaka Khan, and I feel for you. It's 11:21 on Thanksgiving morning. I'm Mark Sebastian, and in sports from last night, the New York Rangers over the Sabres by a score of 3-2.
For Captain Chris, time to kick off the All Request Lost 80s Lunch. We kick things off back to 1983 with Mr. Billy Joel.
WMED.
Today's best music and more variety. It's your Lost 80s Lunch on request for Steve in South Whitney. Gonna do the safety dance. It's Men Without Hats.
We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind.
Fort Wayne's fastest growing radio station. 97.3 WMEE.
Finally I figured out what it took a long, long time.
JC Baker, don't you feel like you've been waiting forever for this 3-day holiday weekend? I'm going to go out shopping and swimming. I'm going to cook out. I'm going to watch the fireworks. And you know that I'll be spending some time trying to get those kids down the street to stop putting off fireworks while my baby's sleeping. Have a happy and safe 4th of July.
WMEE.
In the morning.
WMAE, today's best music and more variety from Missy and Kelly and Auburn at Savage Garden, and I want you.
Anytime I need to see a face, I just close my eyes, and I am taken to a pursuit of crystal mind. I'm a gentle being, they take a chapter in the face of my spine, straight like a chicken cherry cola.
I think it's great. I started listening to it a couple months ago, and it's on in the car, it's on at home in the morning, and it's on all day at work.
WMAE.
From boomers to themers, it's the Lost 80s Lunch on 97.3 WMEE.
Yeah, do you take requests for the lunch period?
Of course, the Lost 80s Lunch. As long as it's an 80s song, we'll do it for you.
Did they have, like, Major Tom?
Lunch tunes on the way. Don't forget the WME rap race and the Mighty Satan Show is rapidly approaching. Less than 10 days away to get those raps built. I'm going to start rolling down the river at high noon. You'll have a chance to grab a share at over $3,000 in prize money. You can pick up entry forms at Midwest America Federal Credit Unions in either Fort Wayne, Huntington, or Decatur. All three McVans video game trader locations. The information booth at Glenbrook Square right here at WME. Or if you need us to fax an entry form, give us a ring at 447-8633. The Raft Race, a Three Rivers Festival tradition from 97.3 WMEE.
WMEE weather.
Your Fort Wayne Metro weather for the rest of today. Partly sunny, not as warm as it's been the last couple of weeks. Sunshine high near 78. Cloudy tonight. Showers, chance of moving in after midnight. Though right around 60. Cloudy with a chance of afternoon thunder showers tomorrow and a high near 70. Much cooler and drier over the 4th of July weekend. Going to be good looking, though. Sunshine highs in the upper 70, lows right around 56. Right now, sunshine 75. R. Kelly from the phone lines from Missy from 97.3.
WMEE.
I used to think that I could not go on.
In the tradition of great 70s stations of the past. You're listening to WNCI's 70s Saturday Night.
70s Saturday Night, WNCI.
Yeah, how about Sylvia's Mother by Dr. Hook?
I'll do it for you.
All right, thank you.
WACI, Dave Sharp.
Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's busy, too busy to come to the phone.
WNCI 97.9, Dr. Hook. Dave Sharp, it's 10:08. Keep your calls coming in because we're here till 12 midnight with all your requests. Call us 821-WNCI or absolutely toll-free at 1-800-822-WNCI.
You like saving money?
Saving money is good.
WNCI cares about Columbus.
WNCI plays more
WNCI. 70 Saturday night, hi.
Jeff, I'd like to request Steve Miller's Fly Like an Eagle.
All right, we'll do it.
Thanks a lot.
WNCI.
super weekend.
70 Saturday night.
Dave!
Yeah?
How you doing?
Good, who's this?
This is, Ronald.
What can we play for you, Ron?
Hey, I'd like to hear Love's Theme by the Love and Limited Orchestra.
Music Radio.
This is WNCI Columbus at 97.9 megahertz on your FM dial.
WNCI.
Seventy Saturday night, who's this?
It's Angela.
Hi, Angela. Well, what'd you like to hear?
I'm going through this, like, flashback period.
Uh-huh.
I want to be 12 years old for 3.5 minutes, and I know you're the guy that can do it.
And so you need to hear?
I want to hear this backwards corn-fed version of BTO's Hey You.
You got it, brothers and sisters!
It reminds me of all the guys in the locker room that used to always string me up and put stuff on me. And
WMCI.
Saturday night, who's this?
Hey, this is John.
What's up, my man?
How you doing, Dave? I love you.
Well, I love you guys, too. What can I play for you?
I Want to Be With You by my favorite band, the Raspberries.
All right.
WNCI.
What can I play for you?
Oh, okay. My husband has made me watch The Tribe all night long.
All right.
And so I've been listening to WNCI on the side, and I would love to hear Cats in the Cradle if you already have. Have you played it?
All right, I'll play it for you now.
Okay, thank you so much.
We believe in music. Music Radio WNCI. WNCI 97.9 means music.
Hey, play me some Helen Reddy.
Leave me alone. The music sounds best on WNCI.
70 Saturday night, hi.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, who's this?
Donna.
Who?
Donna.
Who?
Yeah,
what do you want to hear, Donna?
The night Chicago died, Dave.
The night Chicago died.
You're listening to WNCI's 70s Saturday Night.
70s Saturday Night, WNCI, Columbus.
Saturday night, who's this?
This is Jennifer.
Hey, what can I play for you tonight?
Yo-Yo by Yasmin.
All right, you got it.
Thank you.
They're calling for a yo-yo. Hey, I think that's my cue. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed a look back at radio. Also, just wanted to note that WNCI has kept their Top 40 format for over 45 years. If you'd like to hear current air checks, why not send in a few? Send recordings to me, Phil Wayne, at 7545 County Highway 71, Harpster, Ohio, 43323-9364. All the audio service membership and editors would be most grateful for your contribution. And now, friends and neighbors, the excitement continues with the musings from the members.
This is Musings of the Members. The opinions are those of the speaker and do not represent the DX Audio Service, the National Radio Club, or its editors. Members may muse by calling the Action Line 24 hours a day.
This is John Wesley Smith from Hallsville, Missouri. Fred, I'm sure glad you warned us about that dust in the phone lines. Anyway, a blockbuster issue for April. Thank you to everybody that was involved in putting that together. And I really, really appreciate Mark Durenberger's willingness to put together some oral descriptions of a couple of the things that he mentioned, the sunrise-sunset propagation. I think I personally will pass on that, but thank you very much anyway.
This is Tim Hendel answering Mark's question in the April DX Audio Service. The sunrise-sunset maps, I think, would not be of any interest to me. However, I would be very interested in the nighttime pattern information, but I just don't see how this could ever be conveyed for thousands of radio stations. Maybe one idea would be to only give the patterns for those stations that operate at night with 50,000 watts. Not really sure how that could be done. I really enjoyed the little April Fool thing from Australia about metric time. Yes, I did pick up that that was an April Fool, and I enjoyed it.
This is Mike in Aventura. I really wouldn't be interested in the coverage map, but I do have a question. There's a radio station that's been announced that's coming on the air, WBUR, on 1120 in Coral Springs. I would like to know how to get in touch with them. I believe I've heard that promo, and I have heard the EAS tones in that promo, and for a second, I was wondering, what's going on? Then I asked myself, why are they running the EAS tones in those promos? I'd love to answer Tim Hendrick's question. Yes, there have been a few all-request radio stations. I know of three of them. The first one was WORC. They were on 1310. They were in Worcester, Massachusetts, and they took requests. They were great. The DJs were upbeat, and they had a lot of personality. The second one, unfortunately, I never heard because I was at Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts, and the station was WRIZ 1550. In Coral Gables. And the third one was a station which is now a classical station in Connecticut. It was called WCCC and they were on 1290. I heard them very little when I was in the Connecticut area. I agree with that article about country music radio. Country music radio needs to be local, not syndicated. When I lived in Boston, we had a country music radio station. It was WCOP. They were on 1150. The DJs were great. They had a lot of personality, and they knew the music very, very well.
Hi, DXers. This is Matthew Ellis in Springfield, Missouri. I'll try to keep this brief. I have a few things to talk about. In regard to the pattern maps and stuff being audible, that would be great. I don't know how much I would use them. I don't have a lot of time, or I don't have a lot of neat equipment. I just DX with regular radios, and I live in an apartment. But I would think it would be neat to see what they are. I've never understood them. And I really enjoyed in this issue in April the pirate radio article. That was great. I'm a big fan of that. I had some stuff on my computer, but I lost it all. I did manage to back up the Radio Caroline story that a friend in the UK sent me. There were some clips of some stations I'd never heard of. I'd heard of the stations, but I'd never heard them. So that was great. And everything, so that's great. Interesting new Discovery Nightly here on the dial. It's 1700. Hey, what is it? Kick 1700 from Dallas, which is now Tejano. Booms in every night. I haven't heard anything. Did they do a power increase? Did they change directions on their antenna? And I just didn't know because they've always been in the background. And they are really clear. They fade in occasionally with Des Moines. I think it's the Champ. I don't know what it's called. But it's impressive. I usually don't get Spanish stations remotely, if at all. Not like that, especially. So it's kind of exciting there. Seems to be automated most of that, actually all the time that I've heard it. No stream, so I can't hear it otherwise. And that kind of thing. So. And also, I wonder for EDXN if an app for iPhone, Android, etc. could ever be developed. I use my iPhone and my iPad a lot more than my computer, and Safari on the phone is having issues focusing with the screen reader voiceover right now. So a couple of months ago on 1160, out of nowhere, very clearly I picked up Radio Educación, I believe it is, from Mexico City, which I've never gotten. It was playing... seem to be playing it. Well, it played like some kind of Hindi, kind of South Asian music, and the next air came that played classical music. Does anyone know what this is? Is it just, does it kind of play whatever? I can't find much information about it. It seemed kind of interesting. 73 and good DX.
Yes, this is Tom Bilton in Charleston, South Carolina, and I just started listening to my DX audio service for April today. I want to say to Mark Durenberger that I very much appreciate your offer to possibly do an oral presentation of the sunset maps and the night pattern. But that's something that's always been interesting to me. But, you know, I didn't know of any way to have access. So if you do that, my vote is definitely yes, and I would definitely take advantage of it. So thank you very, very much.
Hello, audio service members. This is Mike Dukin calling from Hayward, Wisconsin, and I have a couple of format flips in the Duluth Superior area. First, I'd like to say that WWJC 850 on the AM dial has changed their call letters and ownership. They are now owned by VCY America, Christian organization out of Milwaukee, and they have changed their call letters to WQRM. Now, this happened during the month of March, and as I understand it, the VCY bought the station for $400,000. That, to me, sounds like that's cheap for a station. I'm not exactly sure there, but that's what they're doing, bringing VCY programming, and they have given up their commercial status and their total non-commercial station. They've been on the air since 1963, by the way. And WGEE from Superior on 970 also made a switch. They were running the Music of Your Life format from Cumulus, and they've been doing that for 8 years. Now they are they have split the CBS Sports Radio, and that's what they're doing now. So that's the latest from this area, and I'll just simply say 73s and good DX.
Hello, this is Mike Terry in the UK. I'm reading a very interesting book entitled Border Radio by Gene Fowler and Bill Crawford. I've never actually heard any of these Border Blaster stations, and I wondered if there's any chance that anybody could put any on the audio circle. That would be really interesting. Thank you for some really good monthly programs, which I always listen to and thoroughly enjoy. Oh, and incidentally, I've just completed the London Marathon, and some of my training was listening to tapes of your internet broadcast of the monthly program. So thank you for that, and cheerio from Bournemouth in the UK.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. And to answer Mike Lance's question about the broadcaster's name is Langer Broadcasting, L-A-N-G-E-R, at 94 St. Rose Street in Boston, Massachusetts, 02130. Their telephone number given was area code 617-522-4889. Now, that could be an attorney, that could be somebody in a corporate office someplace, but that's the name on the application for the radio station. If you happen to call them, Find out what they're going to be doing and let us all know here on the DX Audio Service. Just a reminder to those of you who subscribe to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in the MP3 format, please let us know about that. Just simply drop me an email at fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. Just put in the subject line, I listen. If you want to write me a little short message and tell me how you like the DX Audio Service or make some suggestions, that's fine. The only thing you'll get back from me is just a simple email saying, thanks for letting us know. Unless you have a question or so, in which case I'll answer it. But you won't be added to a list. We won't contact you anymore. We just like to find out who's listening to the MP3 version of the DX Audio Service. Let's do some news now and let you go your own way.
You can go your own way. Go your own way.
Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service, a nonprofit organization devoted to the radio listening hobby.
High-powered history, radio history by the Bay, by Barry Mishkind in the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource for April 2014. This month marks the 92nd anniversary of the first intentional AM directional antenna in the U.S. About a decade ago, Ron Rackley found the site and tried to get permission for an historical marker to be placed there. We met him at the Clearwater, Florida site to discuss how radio transmission techniques have changed over the years. In March 1932, it was the location of a revolutionary advance in AM broadcasting. Now the site is in a slightly overgrown section of land next to a gas station convenience store. Today, directional antennas are common in broadcasting, from the Yagi-type antennas used for auxiliary services to the multi-tower arrays used to shoehorn AM stations into markets with ever-increasing power. We use them for signal enhancement or signal reduction. Directional antennas permit operation where non-directional activity just would not accomplish the technical requirements. At the same time, once installed, most directional antennas seem to be given little attention. They work so well, one consultant suggested, we might soon run out of engineers who truly understand them. Yet, in a true "they said it couldn't be done" story, the very first directional antenna used in broadcasting was almost not finished. Naysayers thought it was impossible to set up and run. It would just be a vain pursuit. The story of AM directional antennas begins in 1925 with George W. Bowles, a real estate entrepreneur in Dunedin, Florida. As the west coast of Florida began to be developed, there was a need to get people to buy property and move down to retire in the sun. Bowles somehow learned about Walter Tyson, a ham operator who had been instrumental in providing the first transmitter for WSB in Atlanta. Tyson, no longer attached to WSB, was seeking to sell his transmitter to another potential broadcaster, so Bowles arranged to bring Tyson and his 500-watt transmitter to Dunedin, where it was installed on the roof of the Fenway Hotel. Amid appropriate fanfare, WGHB went on the air on December 10, 1925. As with most early stations, at first the studio was on the roof along with the transmitter, accessible only via a long ladder. Just in time for the grand opening, a studio was finished at ground level, so dignitaries would not have to climb the ladder. The impact was immediate. During the inaugural broadcast, some 425 telegrams were reportedly received from 36 states and Canada. Unfortunately, the real estate boom in Florida was having troubles, which in turn created cash flow problems for Bowles. Forced to sell his interests in the Fenway and the radio station, the station was moved to Edward Haley's Fort Harrison Hotel in Clearwater. Rechristened WFHH in early February 1927, the station essentially was operated by the Clearwater Chamber of Commerce. Then, 6 months later, a station down in Boca Raton died, and they got the call sign they really wanted, WFLA, West Florida. WFLA did not operate alone for long, although it had a good allocation on 850 kilocycles. In addition to the half dozen other area stations like WDAE, WFLA had to justify its continued existence to the Federal Radio Commission, the FRC. Since all stations were essentially non-directional at the time, only a limited number of stations could operate at night without excessive interference to others. That led to tremendous pressure on the FRC to eliminate those stations operating only part-time and replace them with facilities that promised to use the increasingly crowded dial to the full. The solution for WFLA was to sell a half interest in the station to a neighboring Chamber of Commerce. The St. Petersburg Chamber of Commerce quickly agreed to put $6,000 in to share the transmitter. Taking the calls WSUN, Why Stay Up North, to lure visitors, the St. Petersburg station was permitted 3 days a week and alternate Sundays for their operation on the new and better frequency of 590 kilocycles. From there, the sister stations, now WFLA, WSUN, were moved to 620 kilocycles with 2,500 watts daytime and 1,000 watts at night, beckoning northerners to enjoy the sun and warm Gulf waters. Although there were a few other stations on the 620 frequency, one of them was owned by the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal, seeking to increase its signal to 5,000 watts, WTMJ asked the FRC to either abolish WFLA-WSUN or cut its power. To further press its rights, WTMJ went to court. The U.S. Court of Appeals directed the FRC to adjust WFLA-WSUN to protect WTMJ's service area. The FRC, an agency with limited control over the broadcast industry, responded by reducing WFLA-WSUN's power to 500 watts daytime and 250 watts at night. This action essentially deprived them of the listeners they needed for both the success of the stations and their communities. At this point, the future operation of WFLA-WSUN looked rather bleak. Without access to listeners in the North, there was little value to the Chambers of Commerce in operating a radio station. They even considered turning in the license. But Walter Tyson was no one to give up. He approached the situation in two ways. First, he applied for a huge increase in power for the station, WTMJ's court order notwithstanding. Then he contacted Commander T.A.M. Craven, the consulting engineer for WFLA-WSUN, for assistance in designing and constructing a directional antenna. While there had been experiments on directive receiving antennas and some transmitting facilities, it was mainly for shortwave point-to-point usage. Furthermore, some engineers derided the concept of using a directive antenna at AM frequencies, suggesting the real problem was the way the WFLA-WSUN signal went across the Gulf of Mexico and turned up the Mississippi River Valley to reach Milwaukee. Others simply said the ionosphere did not have a smooth surface, and the resulting propagation would not be as anticipated. Craven, Ted Craven, as he was known, who would go on to serve as the first lead engineer at the FCC and later an FCC commissioner, decided Tyson's solution had potential for success. He then enlisted the aid of Ray Wilmot, a British engineer. Wilmot had done quite a lot of study into the way directional antennas worked, and he concurred this was the right option for WFLA-WSUN. In fact, Wilmot was so sure of himself that he agreed to be paid only if he was successful. Together, Craven and Wilmot undertook to construct the antenna. Calculations were carefully made regarding the ground wave and sky wave toward Milwaukee. The tower bases and guy anchors were laid along the Davis Causeway, later renamed the Courtney Campbell Causeway, in Clearwater in March 1932, and tests began in May of that year. A 200-foot self-supporting tower was constructed on either side of the road, a quarter wavelength apart, in line with the bearing toward Milwaukee, 346 degrees. The transmission circuit itself was quite simple, with the lines cut to length and then routed in a curved way to the towers. One tower was coupled with a coil, the other was coupled with a condenser to shift the signal so that the phase angle between the two towers was 90 degrees. The result was a tight cardioid pattern, with the minima at 346 degrees toward Milwaukee. Engineers were sent out into the field with such measuring meters as existed then, as well as radios. However, even with such a simple array, the tune-up did not go as quickly or as easily as expected. It soon became apparent to the constructors that they had not fully taken mutual impedance factors into account, as even the relatively primitive measuring equipment available showed that the two antennas were behaving differently. Thus, much of the additional tuning was done by making adjustments until the signal faded out at the location of the monitoring engineers. In the end, it turned out Wilmot was right in his calculations, and a satisfactory deep null was obtained toward Milwaukee. The final pattern sent a strong signal to the north while reducing the signal toward Milwaukee well below required levels. In fact, the antenna worked so well that the FRC inspector in Atlanta, who was to measure the frequency of the station, instead had to ask if WFLA-WSUN had authority to be off the air because he couldn't hear them. Indeed, the two-tower WFLA-WSUN directional antenna was a complete success. It operated for 18 years from the site on the causeway, accompanying the city's entry gate as a sentinel marking the entrance to Clearwater. Quite a few transmitter logs have been saved from the operation of the plant, and the stability of the first AM directional antenna still can be seen today. Of special interest is some of the terminology used in the logs. Engineers carefully noted the operating parameters and special situations. Among the logs are notes relating to repairs done, even the reduction in power used during the later stages of World War II. Perhaps to describe the effect of the directional array in terms better understood in 1932, Tyson referred to it often as a shield or shielded transmission to indicate a shield that kept the signal from going toward Milwaukee. Dutifully, the engineers noted each day when the array was shielded or shield put on. Mishkin says, "I did look at quite a few of the logs, but none of them said shields up." Apparently no Starfleet officers worked at WFLA-WSUN. The two stations continued to send joint southern greetings to folks up north for about 8 years. But the Clearwater Chamber of Commerce then had had enough and sold its half interest, the WFLA part, to the Tampa Tribune, which promptly changed the station's home to Tampa. With both WFLA and WSUN wanting full-time operation, their separation would not be long in coming. WFLA moved in January 1941 up to 940 kilocycles, later 970, in Tampa, while WSUN stayed on 620. The Clearwater site was abandoned in 1950, with WSUN moving to St. Petersburg proper, replicating the directional antenna pattern a few miles south along the Gandy Causeway with two 500-foot self-supporting Blaunox towers. Today, both facilities, 620 and 970, are owned by Clear Channel Communications. As has been common with a number of consolidated groups, there have been changes made to improve each station's coverage, as well as a sort of musical chairs effect on call signs. The call sign and its associated programming, now on 620, is WDAE, a sports station with a long history on 1250. The Gandy Causeway site was rebuilt in 2007 with 360-foot towers and a modest increase in licensed power. That has been augmented by a continuing series of special temporary authorities for 10,000 watts, to combat interference received from Cuban broadcasts, still without sending excessive radiation toward Milwaukee. The WFLA calls continue over on 970, with the power now increased to 25,000 watts day, 11,000 nights, into five towers of a six-tower array shared with WHNZ, the current occupant of 1250. Ron Rackley, the consulting engineer for the stations, has long had an interest in the history of the WFLA-WSUN 620 facility back to 1932, specifically because it was the first directional antenna in the world used for AM broadcasting. Although he knew the original location of the station was at the end of the Courtney Campbell Causeway, the exact location was not readily apparent. Rackley and Wilson Welch, then the Gulf Coast Director of Engineering for Clear Channel, wondered if any of the original site remained. They sought any information available as to the exact location and hunted for clues. Finally, someone discovered an old picture of the site near the causeway. A sewage plant now stands on the site of the South Tower. Using the photo as a guide, Welch finally discovered the right location next to a gas station and convenience store. After exploring the area, the original base for the North Tower of WFLA-WSUN was found, still in place, hidden in a clump of trees on the backside of a field. At the time, a new drive-through coffee shop was said to be coming to the site. However, the property is still undeveloped as of the time of writing. About 100 feet back from the road, in a clump of trees, there it was, as it had been for decades. Even better, after brushing away some of the vegetation, the date of March 8, 32, when the tower bases were poured, was clearly visible. As you can imagine, Rackley and Welch, along with others, would love to see an historical marker placed on this site to commemorate the start of this first of all directional antennas and the men who conceived and built it. Unfortunately, up to this time, the owner of the property has not shown any interest in having this done, but hope continues that some arrangements might be made at some point in the future. So now you know the whole story behind this site and the stations that were here. Perhaps the next time you drive past a directional antenna site, whether it be 2 towers or 12, you might just stop to pause for a moment and remember Ray Wilmot and his pioneering designs that made it all possible. I would like to offer thanks to Ron Rackley of Dutrail, Lundeen & Rackley, Wilson Welch, and Vincent Luisi, director of the Dunedin Historical Society, for their kindness in sharing their time and information in search of the history of the WFLA and WSUN operation. This has been High Powered History, Radio History by the Day by Barry Mishkind in the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource for April 2014. I'm Mark Dernberger.
Clouds over cumulus, radio ratings plunge. This article was written by Winton Hall and appeared on the website Breitbart.com. A prestigious radio industry analyst and author of Inside Music Media revealed on Thursday a stunning ratings nosedive across a broad array of formats for Cumulus Media's Citadel acquisition. In addition to its virtual implosion of its bedrock conservative AM talk stations, Cumulus' dramatic decline in numbers is meaningful because the Citadel acquisition made the company highly leveraged with $2.23 billion of debt. Since acquiring Citadel in September 2011, Cumulus' ratings plunge has resulted in stunning losses of audience share for 39 of 42 major stations, including such flagships as WABC New York down 44%, KABC Los Angeles down 52%, WLS Chicago down 57%, KGO San Francisco down 58%, KSFO San Francisco down 38%, WBAP Dallas down 32%, WLS FM Chicago Classic Hits down 45.9%, KLOS FM Los Angeles Classic Rock down 24.6%, WGVX FM Minnesota Sports down 80.8%, WKDF FM Nashville Country down 45.2%, WDVD FM Detroit Hot Adult Contemporary down 38.3%, KBEE FM Salt Lake City Hot Adult Contemporary down 50%. As the data above reveals, the decline has been broad-based and steep in a host of genres that have previously been considered bulletproof, like country and sports. In addition, Cumulus Ratings Vortex has eviscerated its traditionally strong talk radio audience, which has been a stanchion of the grassroots conservative movement for over 20 years. Jerry Del Cagliano of Inside Music Media says Cumulus CEO Lou Dickey has lost talent, fired what remained, and single-handedly killed talk radio. Last year, conservative luminary Sean Hannity sent shockwaves through the radio world when he decided to dump the Dickies and Cumulus for Clear Channel. The results for Cumulus have not been pretty. Hannity replacement Michael Savage has seen a 49% loss in the all-important 25 to 50 age demographic on WABC New York and WBAP AM Dallas. Still, the Dickies have made a small fortune. In 2011 and 2012, Lou Dickey reportedly bagged $22,080,673 in combined total compensation. Cumulus VP John Dickey scored $6,626,687. This comes at a time when the Dickey's business strategy has been to radically slash costs and staff. "You try doing this damage on just one station and you're fired," said Jerry Del Colliano. "The Dickies do it and they are compensated." Conservatives say the Dickies exacerbated Cumulus woes when they decided to add Mike Huckabee to the Cumulus lineup in an effort to soften the conservative message by bringing, as Huckabee put it, more conversation, less confrontation. Huckabee's official online store now offers T-shirts bearing the phrase. Huckabee struggled to gain traction and was canceled in December 2013. That same year, the Dickies also launched a radio show hosted by Geraldo Rivera in an effort to occupy the militant middle and be a referee between ideologies, according to Rivera. Last year, Geraldo's show lost national syndication. Cumulus also lost Rush Limbaugh in New York to WORAM after Lou Dickey blamed Limbaugh for the loss of millions of dollars in advertising following the Sandra Fluck controversy, a claim Rush refuted and that sources close to Limbaugh say were merely an attempt to blame him for the Dickey's revenue problems. Prominent Wall Street analysts are starting to reconsider the Cumulus model. TheStreet.com rates Cumulus as a hold with a C- rating score. "We do not recommend additional investment in this stock despite its gains in the past year, compared to other companies in the media industry and the overall market. Cumulus Media Incorporated's return on equity significantly trails that of both the industry average and the S&P 500. The company, on the basis of change in net income from the same quarter 1 year ago, has significantly underperformed when compared to that of the S&P 500 and the media industry. The net income has significantly decreased by 87.4% when compared with the same quarter 1 year ago, falling from $56.05 million to $7.04 million. Last December, Cumulus Media Holdings finalized a $2.23 billion loan to refinance its debt. In Lexington, Kentucky, this is Chris Gay for the DX Audio Service.
From Radio Insight, one day after revealing a new Good Time Oldies network to debut on April 28th, Cumulus Media Networks has revealed they will stop distributing Scott Shannon's True Oldies channel at the end of June. The new Westwood One Good Time Oldies promo sheet states the format will target men 45 to 64 with a music mix featuring 60% 1960s, 25% 1970s, and 15% 1950s and 1980s, described as the golden era of pop, rock, and soul. Hit music of the 60s and 70s with a healthy portion of Oh Wow songs from other decades. The music is up-tempo and the presentation is full of energy, including features about rock and roll history and the timeless artists of the era. To contrast, Westwood One's Classic Hits Network is 60% 1970s, 25% 1980s, and 15% 1960s. Shannon's True Oldies channel currently airs on over 100 stations nationwide, including Cumulus Oldies 98.9 Atlanta. The network's future had been up in the air since Shannon departed Cumulus 95.5 WPLJ New York for WCBS-FM. Shannon intends to seek a new distributor to keep the network running. Interestingly, Cumulus registered TrueOldiesHouston.com for its 104.1 KRBE HD2 channel on March 14th. Likely, the local station management had no idea of the plans coming from the network side of the company. In Harpster, Ohio, I'm Phil Wayne for the DX Audio Service.
Missing the glory days of Top 40 Radio. This article was written by Richard Wagoner in the Los Angeles Daily News on March 19th, 2014. And I might add that this article is written in the first person and is the point of view of the author and his experiences. I got to thinking the other day how radio has changed over the years. Not that the subject is very far from my mind. I grew up in what might be called the glory days of at least two formats. Old enough to remember Top 40 radio at its best, as well as what was once called progressive and later album-oriented rock radio at the height of that format's popularity. So I know that every time I write a column regarding what I like about radio, or perhaps more accurately, what I miss about radio, I'm dating myself. Not as much as I could, though, as Top 40 actually had a renaissance in the early 1980s, when stations like Chuck Martin's K-West 106, now KPWR 105.9 FM, or Jerry DeFrancesco's Kiss FM 102.7 adopted the format. Both stations were great examples of Top 40 radio. While K-West didn't make it, Kiss FM shook up the industry with its amazing success, including ratings of over a 10 share. Compare that with what is now considered successful, anything over a 3% share of the audience. Aside from my memory and my rose-colored glasses, there are elements of radio that truly have been lost. Things that I miss that I believe were some of the reasons that radio was once so important to generations of kids, and now so very not. Do kids listen to radio? Certainly, yes. Do they love radio and identify with any station? Hardly. So here are things I wish radio would do better and do more often. First, I wish more stations would play music on AM radio. Stations I loved growing up, including some Top 40 greats, KHJ, KRLA, KEZY, and there was even AOR, such as when Dave Foreman took KEZY into an AOR alternative format. Music can sound good on AM, with a clean signal and a good radio. I miss call letters. The great stations of the past all had them. The already mentioned KHJ, KRLA, and KEZY, and there were obviously more. KMET, KLOS. Yes, many stations still use calls, but the trend here and nationwide is to use clever names. Hot 92.3, Power 106, MyFM, whatever 98.7 calls itself now. Names are okay, but they lack something in my mind. Even UCLA's student campus station, KLA, lost all of its history and respect when it decided to call itself Bruin Radio. Yuck. I miss entertaining DJs, or more accurately, DJs who were allowed to entertain. The jocks on KHJ and KMET were all important friends to us growing up. Does anyone even know the name of the afternoon drive DJ on the typical station today? Why can't the sound's talented on-air staff talk about the records they play instead of a mystery voice? I miss weather reports and surf reports. I may be alone here, but I miss news on stations other than news and talk stations. News that was important to teens and young adults is one of the reasons that KMET connected so well with its audience when Sam Bellamy programmed the station, and one reason why KMET is so fondly remembered 28 years after it left the air. DJs who were allowed to talk about things without a music bed under them. It used to be called clutter when you had unimportant elements in the way of programming. Now it's the way it's done. Are we listeners that impaired that we need music playing while the DJ tells us the details of the upcoming hour of programming? What about real competition? KMET would pass out bumper stickers at a concert sponsored by KLOS. KHJ would fly a banner over an event sponsored by KRLA. Stations would try to scoop each other in getting the latest record from the hot artists. Those competitive rivalries made radio fun for the listeners, and for the DJs and the staff as well. Fun, easy to win contests. My friend Jeff and I still talk of the time he won Wham! Walking Around Money from 10Q in the 1970s, calling in from a rotary dial phone. Everything now is so convoluted it loses the fun factor. Makes you wonder if today's programmers ever even heard what I would consider good radio. Jeff was lucky, of course, because my parents wouldn't let me dial long distance. I have more wishes for radio, and I'm sure you do too. Let's compare notes. This has been Missing the Glory Days of Top 40 Radio. The article was written by Richard Wagoner in the Los Angeles Daily News on March 19, 2014. Richard Wagoner is a San Pedro, California freelance writer covering radio in Southern California. Send him an email at rwagoner, that's R-W-A-G-O-N-E-R, at cox.net. And tell him you heard this article read on the DX Audio Service. In Dallas, Texas, I'm Wally Warrow.
Radio Caroline, 50 years on. The Man Who Pressed the On Button by Lawrence Colley, BBC News. It started with a welcome, a frequency number, and a track by the Rolling Stones, Not Fade Away. Radio Caroline launched 50 years ago from a ship moored off the Essex coast. But while much is known of the DJs who became household names, what of the man who put the station on the air? There are not many people in Sweden who can tell their grandchildren that they were a pirate. Ove Sostrom, now in his 70s, is one of the few who can. It was Mr. Sostrom who got Radio Caroline ready and who, on Easter Sunday, 1964, pressed the button to broadcast. Radio Caroline was an offshore, unlicensed radio station which helped pave the way for modern commercial radio. Transmitting from international waters, Radio Caroline only became formally illegal in 1967, and with one flick of a finger, Mr. Sostrom altered, or perhaps set, the course of UK radio history. His involvement with the station began when Ronan O'Rahlihy, the founder of Radio Caroline, visited Sweden to see Radio Nord, a Swedish offshore commercial station anchored in waters off Stockholm. O'Rahlihy learned of a talented young engineer who had done work on Nord. That man was Mr. Sostrom, who was at the moment in Liberia. Before Mr. Sostrom left for Africa, he gave Alan Crawford a lot of advice for his project Radio Atlanta, Caroline's rival, but he says he was never paid for that advice. On his return to Sweden from Liberia, his mother, who did not speak a word of English, told him of a strange call from a foreigner. The caller in question was Mr. O'Rahlihy. Mr. Sostrom said, "Ronan and I got on well from the start. He asked me if I would come over and help start up a pirate radio ship, and I said, of course." He first laid eyes on the Caroline ship, the 702-ton former Danish passenger ferry Fredericia, when he arrived in Ireland. "I had to start from the beginning. We started to put in the transmitters and all the necessary things. The pieces came in, we put it together," he said. While in the Irish port of Grenoir, the Caroline team carried out a test transmission. "I mean, we had to be sure everything was working," he said. "It blocked out television reception, and you could see on the harbor lights that the lamps were blinking to the music. You could see the music in the lamps. I think we did it for a couple of nights." The plan, he said, was always to station the ship off the Essex coast. He said, "One thing I never told anybody. When Atlanta came to about a kilometer away, me and some other Swedes took out a lifeboat to Atlanta and told the crew there that we had been working on that ship. They said, 'Come aboard.' What I did, because I was quite sore at Crawford and Atlanta, I went down to the transmitter room and cut off a couple of things so they would blow up the tubes. That's why they didn't come on the air, and that's why Radio Caroline didn't have to bother about the competition. That was my revenge." When the moment came to turn on the Radio Caroline transmitter, there were many people around, he says. "The big switch on, which happened on a calm sea, is a moment Mr. Sostrom no longer remembers. There was a big switch to operate the transmitters," he says. "I have a faint memory, but I'm not sure. I was down in the transmitter room the whole time." After the switch on, he walked around tentatively, looking for sparks or signs of any problems. He remained with Caroline for nearly 2 years, working 2 months on the ship, 1 month at home in Sweden. His time with Caroline ended when his wife fell pregnant. Although no longer an offshore radio station, Radio Caroline continues to broadcast via satellite and over the Internet. Asked whether he appreciated his own role in getting Radio Caroline on the airwaves, Mr. Sostrom, who now splits his time between Sweden and the Caribbean, said, "Oh yes, and I loved it." This has been Radio Caroline 50 Years On, The Man Who Pressed the Button, by Lawrence Colley, BBC News. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, and you should know that I'm recording this exactly 50 years after the button was pushed, on Easter Sunday, 2014.
Sure enough, the governor decries last week's raid on Boston's unlicensed Touch 106.1. The Boston Globe says no less of a figure than Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick revealed that his office tried to intervene before last week's raid by U.S. Marshals and the Federal Communications Commission. And talk about a pirate station operating openly. Governor Patrick said, "I've been on it many times, and I have tremendous respect for the team over there." If Touch, operated by a former police officer named Charles Clemens, were coming along today, it would have applied for a 100-watt low-power FM license, and it would certainly have a strong backing. The question is, now that the feds have seized the equipment, will local and state politicians be able to intervene at the Federal Communications Commission? And if they do, what kind of precedent does this set? The Globe says city councilors and state representatives vowed to exhaust every option to get the station up and running again. There is no question that Touch FM ably served the local African-American community and was tolerated unofficially by virtually everyone in Boston. The pro-crackdown folks say that Touch is an example of what happens when an unlicensed station is allowed to put down deep roots, because when it eventually gets busted, things get pretty messy. The Globe says that Governor Patrick's office has reached out to the Federal Communications Commission to try to get the station back on the air. In 2008, Charles Clemens was issued a $17,000 fine by the Federal Communications Commission, which he ignored. That's it for the DX Audio Service for May 2014. We're way over time, so we got to get out of here. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month with more DX stuff. Get out and support your radio club.